The New York Times caught me driving on the New Jersey Turnpike on Monday. I had to pull over into a gas station to talk about the Federal Records Act, and that had to be a first.
Hillary Clinton's email habits as Secretary of State sent journalists desperately seeking archivists. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The video of ISIS militants demolishing ancient artifacts is pure propaganda for a brand of extremism that knows no bounds.
If you watch the video of the destruction at this museum, one of the things that one of the fighters screams is, even if these things are worth $1 billion, we don't care, they're haram, they're forbidden, and he goes ahead and smashes them.
And 12-step programs are Hollywood's cinematic panacea.
It's got spooky music during the drunken scenes. And then when the character goes to AA, suddenly there are these triumphant violins.
Stay tuned.
Since you're listening to this show, I'm guessing you may be wondering about what happens to your privacy, your rights, and even your behavior when you go online. If you do, you might want to check out WNYC's New Tech City. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the WNYC app.
WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, the New York Times published an article by Michael Schmidt with the headline, Hillary Clinton used personal email account at State Department, possibly breaking rules. The media coverage that ensued wasn't quite so measured.
Another potentially major scandal tonight for Hillary Clinton.
Accused of exclusively using a personal account to conduct official government business.
And involves tens of thousands of emails from Clinton's four-year tenure as Secretary of State.
The questions tonight, did she break the law? Is she hiding something?
The media couldn't agree whether Clinton had, in fact, broken a rule or a law. And if so, which one? While Connor Friedersdorf at The Atlantic's website said that, quote, this was willful, flagrant disregard for public records rules, a former Sunlight Foundation director blogged that if Hillary wanted to keep something off the record, she would just pick up the phone like everyone else in public service. Hardly comforting. For her part, Clinton released a statement Tuesday saying that for government business, she emailed them on their department accounts with every expectation they would be retained. The next day she tweeted, I want the public to see my email. I asked State to release them. They said they will review them for release as soon as possible. On Thursday, Reuters reported that the State Department expects the review to take months. Thomas Blanton, director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, has been working on making the public record public for over two decades. But even he was surprised by the intense interest in this case.
Well, the New York Times caught me driving on the New Jersey Turnpike on Monday. I had to pull over into a gas station to actually talk about the Federal Records Act, and that had to be a first.
And what were they asking you?
Well, the first question was, is this totally over the edge? And the answer was, actually not. This seems to have happened dozens of times with how many public officials, Karl Rove in the Clinton White House. I would tell them the story of us bringing the lawsuit to save the White House email back in 1989. And the story of getting Bill Clinton's White House to put in an electronic archiving system. And he said, really? This has been going on that long? And I said, yeah. And even today, federal agencies aren't even required to save all their email and aren't required to do so until 2016. And so, you know, one reporter just said to me, look, there's only one question my editors want you to answer. Did she break the law? And I said, well, the answer is yes. And no. And he said, oh my gosh, can't you just make it one or the other?
What about Clinton's defense that in all of her official correspondence, she used the recipient's official email address and therefore those emails are already archived within the government? Does that hold any water?
It holds some water. Certainly most of an email she sent would reside on official servers, but probably in various departments. So emails she sent to officials in the Defense Department or elsewhere would not necessarily be included on the State Department.
But they would be at the Pentagon.
Right, but there's a core argument that the central system of records for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is the one that's on her server, and you shouldn't be relegated to finding copies of it in other places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Federal Records Act calls for systems of records that really preserve and maintain the records of real importance to history. And what is more important to our diplomatic history than the messages sent and received by the Secretary of State? So the argument that, hey, copies exist in the recipient's email, that's fine, but it only goes so far. It doesn't meet your responsibility under the law.
Under the law that was finally ratified after she left that position?
No, I would argue that the Federal Records Act has been around for decades.
Since 1950,
yeah.
But didn't specifically reference digital communication.
That's correct, but the principle that you got to save your records if they're of historical or administrative or evidentiary importance, that's been in the law, and it doesn't matter what the medium is. The defense that Ms. Clinton's spokespeople have offered that I think is stronger is simply that they checked to see what her predecessors had done, and finding out that Colin Powell systematically used personal email, which he writes about in his memoir. Well, that's pretty interesting. If you're Ms. Clinton, you're coming as new Secretary of State, and you've got your Republican predecessor of very high standing having done exactly this, you think, okay, that's all right. I'm covered.
Of course, she is in a White House where even Obama's BlackBerry emails were double backed up on government servers.
Exactly. And that, I think, is the weakness of her defense, because President Obama, to his enormous credit, we had a pending lawsuit against George W. Bush, who got rid of President Clinton's archiving system for email.
Made it even more impenetrable.
Well, it ended up with whole days of the vice president's office featuring no incoming or outgoing email. That seems a little odd.
It was all in a man-sized safe.
And they blamed it on a technological transition that, oh, it just didn't get saved in the same way. So we had to get back into court, just like we'd done against Reagan and Bush 41, and force them to create a new e-archiving system. And President Obama, from day one, has abided by that, and all his BlackBerry messages are double backed up and so forth. And the Obama message to the rest of the government in settling that case is, everybody should be doing this. And that's the moment when agencies should have just said, well, the White House is doing this, we better do it. And unfortunately, that did not happen.
Okay, so you're saying this was going on across the government.
Right.
So what do you think, and this is a political question, what do you think of Jack Schaefer's recent column? He's the Politico media columnist and by no means a Clinton apologist.
Of course.
And he wrote this week that, quote, the press would never force an ordinary politician to sweat over such an indiscretion unless the emails actually contained newsworthy surprises. But Clinton's hide has been so tenderized by scandals and pseudo-scandals over the past two decades that the hounds of the press can't resist nipping on her flesh when they catch the scent.
Boy, he's got a way with the phrase, doesn't he?
He does. But that seems to be true, doesn't it?
You know, in her case, she's not only a major personality and celebrity, but most people think she's running for president. And this practice of the private email may have been fine for Colin Powell, but I kind of bet if Colin Powell had been running for president in 2008, it might have become an issue then.
Now, to be clear, Schaefer thinks the press should be nipping at her flesh. In fact, he thinks there's probably news in the emails that she didn't turn over. Do you?
That may be true. I don't know that for a fact. And my bet is, given the hyper levels of attention that they certainly must have expected, the Clinton staff and advisors probably bent over backwards to give as much as possible. And this separating out of the official documents from the personal documents is something that, you know, professional civil servants and archivists do all the time on these official systems. There's just an opening for political critics to say, wait a second, we shouldn't leave it up to Ms. Clinton's aides to do that separation. It wasn't done in the normal process. And my bet is they're going to have to be some kind of State Department intervention, maybe a sampling done by the State Department Inspector General or something like that, just to put to rest that question that you just asked. Is she still hiding something in the rest of those emails not turned over, or were they genuinely the Chelsea and dentist emails?
You love the fact that this story was printed in the Times. It put a big spotlight on a persistent problem. But is this the full-blown scandal that many say it is, or is it merely a symptom?
Without knowing the substance of the content of the emails, you can't draw a conclusion that this is an enormous scandal. But what it should be is a wake-up call that we are way behind the curve on our public record systems. And given the digital reality, it's really easy to save and store electronic records, and it's becoming easier and easier to search them, retrieve them, review them, etc. So this should be the wake-up call to other government officials that it's a no-no. Don't use your private email. You got 20 days max to move something over from your private email if you had to use your private email. But it's got to be in the official systems, period, full stop. And so I think as a documents fetishist, I would say I'm doubly delighted because it raises a set of issues that have been a crisis for 25 years and maybe gives the National Archives and Records Administration some extra juice when it goes to try to enforce this stuff and save our history.
I have to say that you are truly the happiest person I've spoken to all week.
Bless your heart. It's a target-rich environment out there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thomas Blanton is the director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University.
Coming up, ISIS media manipulations hit their targets, no matter who or what they are.
It's sort of the easiest way to say that my value system is radically different from yours, because everyone kills, but not everyone destroys antiquities.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you're looking for a new podcast to try out, may we suggest WNYC's New Tech City? Host Manoush Zomorodi asks questions about tech that you might not even know you care about until you hear them. Like, what is all this reading on a screen doing to my brain? Or why do I get twitchy when my phone's out of reach? It's a podcast that aims to bring a little balance to what may be an intrusively digital life. You can find New Tech City wherever you get your podcasts, including, of course, on the WNYC app.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A video released by the ISIS press office last week featured militants pulverizing ancient artifacts at the Mosul Museum in Iraq.
A religious spokesman for the group condemned the treasures as sacrilegious. These idols and pagans for people in the past centuries were worshipped instead of Allah, he said. When Allah ordered to destroy and remove them, it was an easy matter. We don't care, even if it costs billions of dollars.
Instead of orange jumpsuits and machetes, the perpetrators used sledgehammers and drills. But the relatively austere video still stoked global outrage.
Nightmare at the museum. ISIL fighters destroy centuries-old statues in Mosul in an attack against Iraq's
We're now seeing shocking images of ISIS members laying waste to priceless artifacts in the very cradle of our civilization.
It's a fanatical religious group. They are destroying artifacts that are Christian. They're out destroying all civilization. They're barbarians. These are nuts.
The coverage of the wasting of the Mosul Museum evoked mournful memories of the obliteration of other priceless relics by terrorists in recent years.
In Afghanistan, beautiful, historic Buddhas were destroyed by the Taliban. And in Iraq, the gardens of Babylon were looted and art from the cradle of civilization kept at the Baghdad Museum stolen and vandalized.
The Baghdad Museum, pillaged after the 2003 American invasion, reopened last week in response to the video of the apparent ruination of the artifacts in Mosul. Iraq's Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi.
Today we are opening this museum, Baghdad Museum, to send a message. We will safeguard this heritage.
The ISIS video also hit a nerve with American cultural institutions. Tom Campbell at the Metropolitan Museum of Art voiced the rage of many when he wrote, "Such wanton brutality must stop before all vestiges of the ancient world are obliterated." But hold on. Experts took a closer look and found that actually many, though not all, of the Mosul Museum artifacts were plaster fakes, the originals having been carted away in anticipation of such vandalism. Mustafa Hidayah is a senior writer for ArtInfo.com. He said that the reverberating anger of the West probably does more harm than good.
Initially, the concern was that everything pictured was authentic and everything was destroyed. But it turned out that a great number of the statuary had been transferred to the museum in Baghdad prior to ISIS getting there. And we also know that a component of the statuary and some of the Assyrian reliefs were, in fact, replicas.
The experts took a closer look at the video and determined that they were plaster because of the way they shattered?
Yes, and also based on background information. In a few different points, you can see rebar sticking out of the statues. And this isn't to say that that necessarily means that they're fake, but you can pause the video and look at the stills. There's this sort of chalky white cross-section, and it's very apparent that it's plaster.
Most ISIS propaganda videos seem designed to provoke fear. This one seemed created to make us mad. How and why, do you think?
When we talk about cultural patrimony, which is already a very loaded term, there's this sort of sense of collective ownership. So when you look at, for example, the statement that was released by Tom Campbell, the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, he was saying that we must stop this wanton brutality before all vestiges of the ancient world are obliterated, while there's absolutely no reason to take lightly the destruction of any sort of antiquities. We should be sort of careful about what we're talking about and what the scope of the risk is. If we can sort of pivot to the horrible beheading videos, there has been quite a bit of discussion in the media about the way that those are received and circulated. And it's not so much about taking the threat seriously.
It's about giving ISIS oxygen?
Exactly.
When it comes to the beheadings, the media backlash begins immediately. You don't show the images. You don't feed the animal. Statements from art research institutions parrot unverified reports, and they're not call to account.
Precisely. I want to emphasize that the academic community has been very careful in sort of trying to figure out what was destroyed in Mosul. The University of Chicago maintains a great listserv that has a number of specialists that follow up on these details, and it's still emerging what was lost and what wasn't.
You said that this latest incident mirrors the reports of looting at the Baghdad Museum in the 2003 aftermath of the American invasion. The AP and NPR estimated that maybe 170,000 items had been lost. The number turned out to be closer to 15,000. And roughly a third of those, I guess, have since been recovered. You think that damage was done then when reporters rushed to judgment. So if we exaggerate the destruction, what are we harming? Where does the damage come in?
The damage comes in this perception of there being a wholesale evacuation of a national culture. Because there is this visceral connection to the past that is embodied in these objects, it's part of a national mythology.
So you believe that the media and the art world inflated the hysteria around this video. Why do you think?
So I think you have a sort of a double acceleration in the art world and in the media, both fields that deal with images operating at a very visceral level, where both the art world and the media were handed this video that seemed perfectly attuned to provoke the sensibilities that this is kind of the most excessive symbolic violence you could perpetrate against a civilization.
Which was why ISIS created the video.
Precisely.
But the practical arm of ISIS would never destroy them because they're worth too much, right? How much are they worth?
ISIS has trafficked in antiquities from Syria and Iraq very extensively, and to the tune of millions of dollars. And it is a major source of their revenue. There are two bills coming before the House of Representatives that deal with this question of stemming antiquities trafficking connected to ISIS.
Because some of these artifacts have ended up in the United States. Who's buying them?
A lot of these looted antiquities are quietly shipped away to middlemen throughout the world and delivered to the West. There has been a great deal of backlash. In September 2014, John Kerry held a press conference also at the Metropolitan Museum to announce a Syrian red list of cultural artifacts. And the idea was to circulate images to customs officials.
I think of those Bamiyan statues that were destroyed by the Taliban years ago. The image was so powerful and so painful, even though I personally have no direct link to that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder why.
This is part of the whole logic of terrorism, which is to strike at the things we hold most emotionally dear.
I didn't even know about those statues until they were blown up. But it feels like they're saying, we have the ability not only to kill you now, but to kill your past.
In a sense, dynamiting the Buddhas of Bamiyan was a gesture of refusal of a common ground. It's sort of the easiest way to say that my value system is radically different from yours, because everyone kills, but not everyone destroys antiquities.
Not everyone wants to obliterate the past.
There are countless books and countless conversational threads that begin with why and how that past is constructed, placing it into context, and whether, you know, we correctly fetishize it. Because, of course, while we were very worried about the Buddhas of Bamiyan, a year prior, the Bush administration approved the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository, and that was a clear situation of Native American cultural heritage being grossly disrespected. And nobody at the Met was issuing any statements about that, as far as I know. So what counts as cultural heritage and what doesn't, even though it feels emotional and visceral and basic, to have a sensitive understanding of cultural heritage entails being aware of what counts as patrimony and what doesn't.
If you assume it counts, first of all, you have to know what happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't reward those doing the destruction with the very thing that they want, which is lots of ink and airtime.
Exactly. The reason that video was released, you know, has a lot to do with the fact that they know there is this great previous case study of the Buddhas of Bamiyan with the Taliban. There is a very concrete awareness of the symbolic value of something like this in the press and in the museum community and among the public. It's correct to be alarmed by it, but that alarm should be put into context once we react to the initial reports.
Mustafa, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Mustafa Hadaya is a senior staff writer at artinfo.com.
If ISIS fanatics were looking to spark outrage from the West for smashing priceless artifacts, or facsimiles thereof, they got their wish. 14 years after the Taliban destroyed the Buddhas of Bamiyan, the ISIS video outrage was Antiquity Iniquity Redux. But New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki says it could alienate the very people ISIS might seek to enlist, despite the Quranic passage ISIS uses to justify the destruction.
There's a well-known section in the biography of the Prophet Muhammad that talks about how the Prophet was exiled from Mecca. And when he returned, he refused to go into the Kaaba, which is that famous black rock, until the pagan idols that were inside were removed. So they point to that incident and others as justifying the smashing of idols.
But over 1,400 years,
There's been room in Islam for artworks, whether tapestries or painted works or sculptures. People seem to have been able to grasp through the history of Islam the difference between an idol, a false god, and a piece of artwork depicting something else altogether.
You know, even within jihadi groups, this is an issue of contention. When I was in Timbuktu covering the aftermath of the French liberation of the city, I found thousands of pages of documents that were left behind by the Al-Qaeda cell that had run the city. Handwritten notes dealing with the destruction of the mausoleums of Timbuktu. And what you saw in those notes is there was dissent. There was discussion among them about, you know, should we go ahead and do this? Should we not go ahead and do this? And significantly, I found a letter from the head of Al-Qaeda's branch in North Africa, Abdelmalek Drukdal, which is addressed to the fighters, where he essentially reproaches them for having destroyed the mausoleums. And what he says to them is, theologically, you are correct. These mausoleums are against the law of God, and in a perfect world, we should get rid of them. However, by doing so, you succeeded in really upsetting the people of Timbuktu.
The Al-Qaeda North African leader says you're going to really, really risk backlash from the population, who may also right. be very devout, but not when it comes to their tourist attractions. They may be able to put up with a beheading right. here or there, but lay off their cash cow. Am I being illiberal in my interpretation?
No, I think there's something to that. I mean, this was a city that lived off of its tourism. And these were sites that were just very dear. You know, people of Timbuktu trace their lineage to these various saints. So it's also like going to the grave of a loved one. When I showed up and I started reporting on the aftermath of the Al-Qaeda rule of Timbuktu, you know, asking people about what it was that really upset them, what was the point of no return, I assumed that it was one amputation that happened in Timbuktu of an alleged thief. There was also an execution of a suspected murderer. And I thought those graphic and very violent acts, that those would be the things that really had revolted people. And in fact, where these people lost all sympathy was when they smashed their ancient heritage. That also speaks, I think, Bob, to an important difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You see in this letter from this Al-Qaeda commander where he's essentially telling them, look, you need to be more pragmatic, pulling back from some of this extremism in hopes of getting the people on their side. ISIS is going, you know, headlong into the other direction. If you watch the video of the destruction at this museum, one of the things that one of the fighters screams is, even if these things are worth $1 billion, we don't care. They're haram, they're forbidden, and he goes ahead and smashes them.
Who's more hypocritical? The Al-Qaeda guy who says, never mind ideological purity, we've got to think of political backlash here, mm-hmm. or ISIS, who are destroying antiquities on the grounds of idolatry, but probably selling them to smugglers to raise cash. Who is the worst case to make to potential jihadis?
If I just look out at the landscape of jihadi groups that are out there today, and they fall broadly into two camps, those that are aligned with ISIS or want to become part of ISIS, and those that are under the umbrella of Al-Qaeda or are petitioning to become part of Al-Qaeda, it's my opinion that Al-Qaeda has a more dangerous proposition. They've become smarter. They've become more pragmatic. They understand that you can't win this fight if you completely turn off the population that you're supposed to be ruling. I think they have an organization that can withstand the test of time, whereas ISIS is so brutal and it's going to be very hard to defeat. But the extent of their brutality will eventually be their undoing.
If that takes place and Al-Qaeda, like, for example, Hezbollah and the PLO before it, gain legitimacy, what does that say about the politics of the region?
I think it's deeply problematic. They're becoming very adamant about one thing, and that is that when they do operations, Muslim civilians should not be targeted and should not be the victims. Numerous Muslim civilians are killed in Al-Qaeda attacks, but it's interesting that they are making that distinction. In the fall of 2013, I was sent to Nairobi to cover the attack on the Westgate Mall, which was, you know, one of the posh malls in Nairobi that was attacked by Shabab, Al-Qaeda's franchise in East Africa. And one of the most chilling things that I learned when I was doing interviews with survivors is that those that had actually interacted with the gunmen were given a chance to answer specific Muslim questions, things like, what is the name of the mother of the Prophet Muhammad? Those that answered correctly were spared, and those that did not were executed on the spot. It's my opinion that if they managed to carry out terrorist attacks where only the so-called infidels, you know, us, are the ones who die, and Muslims are spared, that will go very far to exacerbating this clash of civilizations that they're trying to stir up. Because what they are trying to do is create a divide between Muslims and everybody else.
Rukmini, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Rukmini Kalamaki is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Last week, the ISIS militant nicknamed Jihadi John was identified as a British citizen from London. The masked figure shown in beheading videos standing behind his victims is actually Mohammed Emwazi, a former student at the University of Westminster. Soon after he was identified, a video surfaced showing three British girls entering Turkey on their way to join ISIS. And Canadian authorities are seeking a group of teens who reportedly left Montreal to do the same. These events prompted discussion about online recruitment as a tool of violent extremists and why someone who grew up in London would join ISIS.
Questions being asked tonight right here in London. Was it when, at what point was this eloquent, middle-class, educated graduate from the university just behind me, at what point was he radicalized?
All three suspects in this case were at least in part radicalized online through their contact with members of ISIS.
Humaira Khan is the founder and executive director of Muflahan, a Washington think tank dedicated to fighting violent extremism. She teaches workshops for Muslim kids and their parents about online safety and social media, and she believes that online radicalization is not an idle threat, even in the United States.
The last numbers that we have seen, or that were mentioned by the Director of National Intelligence, was that 180 U.S. citizens have actually gone to Syria. We know about 40 of them have come back. So is it a possibility? Yes. The numbers, of course, aren't very high, and they're much lower compared to what we're seeing in Europe or Central Asia or Middle East. But it's not that it's zero.
And what do we know about the process? I presume they're not only predisposed, but actually seeking this kind of, you know, grotesque adventure.
I don't think everyone starts off seeking that particular type of adventure, as you called it. I think a lot of them, where they're starting off initially is the sense of injustice and oppression. And what they're trying to do is help the Syrian people, making the world a better place. Teenagers, young people motivated to change the world is not something new. The question is who they end up finding and how they get pulled into something which is so entirely wrong and so contrary to every ideal that they think they're going towards.
How do they encounter people who exploit their sense of injustice and outrage and turn them violent?
It's different when we are talking about North America versus Europe versus other countries in the world. So in North America, the estimate is almost 90% of recruiting is actually happening online. So these are kids who feel strongly about the plight of the Syrian people. They want to help. They come across people who seem like-minded, and it sort of escalates from there. They're drawn in. The bonds or the relationships are built with a smaller and smaller network. They try their best to break their contact and their relationships with others. Once you have them isolated, then it's easier to indoctrinate them. And then after indoctrination is mobilization.
The psychology you've just described seems to fall exactly between the U.S. Marines' basic training and a pedophile.
Yes. We see the same dynamics, the same patterns in many other things. You also see that for people getting involved in gangs. Cults also use similar mechanisms. But what we're seeing is that this is happening on all your public channels. So you see it on Twitter, you see it on Facebook, Ask.fm, Tumblr. I mean, it's open. And the initial contact and the initial seeking out of people who are like-minded and having conversations is public. And it's only as people start to get more and more entrenched in those circles that they actually start to move them from the public exchanges into the private exchanges.
So the opening salvo is not, let's murder the infidels. It's building a trust relationship. It's building a little esprit de corps and a common cause.
And now that ISIS is now claiming to be a caliphate, the additional recruitment narrative is that you're going to come and help set up a state and you won't have to worry about employment. They're going to give you free housing. All medical expenses are covered. You can get education. You have a monthly stipend. And what you're doing is you're helping establish a new society. So, in fact, you get a bonus if you get married and have kids.
Now, I think I speak for many a parent when I say that I can't even keep track of what my daughter is seeing and posting on Instagram. How is a parent who's concerned about losing their grip on their child able to cope with the ease with which they can find apparently sympathetic voices?
I had a professor of comparative religion who used to say, if you want to stop a man from drowning, you don't stop him from going to the ocean, you teach him how to swim. In this case, it is important for parents to have the dialogue and the conversations with the kids beforehand, so the kids themselves are empowered to stand up for what they believe in. If a youth has a question, if they can't approach their parent or they can't approach a trusted adult or a youth director or someone to have that conversation, they're going to go look for it online. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that because so much of this is around isolating them, this is a place where parents will actually see changes in their kids. In fact, the parents, the family, the friends are the first people who will observe a change. Now, you don't know what the change is about, right? You have no idea whether it's based on a kid going through depression or is being recruited for a gang or is having trouble at school or is facing bullying. Any of those other problems will have very similar manifestations at the start. But that actually gives you the opportunity that if those things are showing up, get help. Because the more we can do around prevention, the more we can do around making sure that parents feel empowered that they can actually deal with the topics, you know, the more you can have happen within families, the better it is.
Humaira, I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Humaira Khan is the founder and executive director of Muflehun, a Washington think tank dedicated to fighting violent extremism.
Coming up, is America addicted to AA?
I'm having a bad day. So if it is not too much to ask of you people, will you just back the off?
Excellent work. Really excellent work.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Hollywood has a recovery problem, thanks to such TV shows as Celebrity Rehab and Intervention and many celebrity memoirs and feature films across the decades. Addiction recovery, especially alcohol addiction, is largely framed around the idea that 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous are not just the best choice, but really the only choice. Gabrielle Glazer, investigative journalist and author of Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control, believes that the 12-step model can do more harm than good, especially to women, and that Hollywood isn't helping.
a retired Harvard psychiatrist named Lance Dotis just did a big takeout called The Sober Truth that looked at surveys and studies over the years and analyses of people who had been in rehab. And that book said that it was successful 5 to 8% of the time.
But I personally know so many people who have used the program and have done well.
Exactly. But you also know a lot of people for whom yoga works really well or for whom Catholicism works really well. But that's not science. That's anecdote. That's narrative.
And this, you suggest, is a very narrative-driven concept.
We in this country adore redemption narratives. Our whole history is based on redemption narratives. Amazing grace, I was blind but now can see. And that is also AA's narrative. You start sneaking drinks, you lose your job, you hit bottom, and then you find AA and you recover.
And there is a lot of what's been called kick-lit celebrity literature about beating your addiction.
Celebrity literature, memoirs about addiction.
Eric Clapton's autobiography.
There you go. Rob Lowe. You know, a lot of famous people have worked the program and it works for them. And therefore, that gives kind of star appeal. We don't hear from the people it doesn't work for.
Well, some of them are dead.
Dead, right.
Amy Winehouse, Whitney Houston, Lindsay Lohan, you have to worry about.
Right.
So we should understand the program as not having worked for them.
Right. Instead of their failure at not working the program correctly.
Why would we think it's their failure?
Well, early in the Bible of Alcoholics Anonymous, the book that was first written and published in 1939, here's what AA tells readers and potential members. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves.
Is this why you think that the program doesn't serve women as well as men?
Women are twice as likely to have been diagnosed with depression or anxiety disorders, and they're far more likely to have been sexually abused. And all of those are risk factors for women. In AA, those are considered outside issues. When my book came out, I heard from hundreds of women who had been discouraged from talking about those issues. And also, if you're prescribed an antidepressant by your doctor, which, by the way, has been shown in many cases to help people stop drinking, you're often considered not sober within the program.
If only 8 out of 100 succeed in this program, why does it have such a fantastic rep?
It's very entrenched in our legal system, our medical establishment, and also our popular culture. In the early 1940s, there was a Saturday Evening Post story about AA that sold hundreds of thousands of copies, and interest really took off throughout the 1940s and 50s. At dinner time, when everybody was watching the news, people who were members of AA were on local TV stations wearing Lone Ranger masks, describing their experiences. And it was very helpful for the organization, and it was no doubt helpful for people who needed help with their drinking. It was an important milestone, culturally and clinically.
But I think even more, it must be the big screen, right? There's lots of movies that AA appears in.
So we had the Thin Man movies in the 1930s where alcohol was just a giant caper. Myrna Loy at one point sits down at the table and says, I can drink as much as he can.
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make 6 martinis.
All right. Will you bring me 5 more martinis? Leo, line them right up here.
Yes, ma'am.
AA hit Hollywood in 1945. There was a woman who was one of the first women in AA to become sober long-term. Her name was Marty Mann, and she was a PR genius. She worked at Marshall Field's in Chicago. She came from a very wealthy family. Her family lost money during the stock market crash. She had a decade of really wandering, and she drank way too much. And she found AA when she was in a sanitarium. A doctor gave her a book, the Big Book. And initially, she rejected it as being far too religious. But she had had a suicide attempt, and somehow she picked it up again and thought, okay, I'll try this. It worked for her, and she wanted to get the message out. She started reaching out to radio producers. She worked with newspapermen, television writers, movie producers, screenwriters, and it really, really worked.
The Lost Weekend, starring Ray Milland.
And that depicted a harrowing journey of this guy who was a writer trying to fix his writer's block.
Come on, I need that liquor. I want it and I'm going to get it, understand? I'm going to walk out of here with that quarter rye, one way or another.
And that was written by a member of AA, whose name was Charles Jackson.
And it's directed by Billy Wilder.
Jackson and Billy Wilder did work with Marty Mann to portray what happens in an alcoholic's downfall in a depiction on screen. And then, huge sea change again in terms of movies, because AA itself was depicted in a movie called The Days of Wine and Roses. It featured Jack Lemmon, Jack Klugman, and Lee Remick. Jack Lemmon has a drinking problem. He brings his girlfriend slash wife along with him for the ride. She doesn't like the taste of alcohol, but he quickly produces Brandy Alexanders, which are sweet.
Oh, no, thank you.
No, that's all right. That's fine.
But
they're special for you. It's chocolate. Go on.
Oh, it's good. Ooh. It is.
And they slide into this terrible descent of alcohol dependence themselves. And in that film, AA was a protagonist. It's got spooky music during the drunken scenes, out-of-control scenes. And then when the Jack Lemmon, Joe Clay character goes to AA, suddenly there are these triumphant violins. Jack Klugman appears. He is the sponsor of Jack Lemmon and brings him to meetings. You see these meetings portrayed for the first time on the large screen. My name is blank, and I'm an alcoholic. It's easy to forget that enormous numbers of people went to the movies in the 1950s and 60s. So everybody was consuming that at the same time.
And AA is still popping up on the big screen now?
The movie with Andy Garcia and Meg Ryan, When a Man Loves a Woman, 28 Days with Sandra Bullock.
You know, if you really try, Daniel, you could ruin the experience for the entire patient population.
I'm having a bad day. So if it is not too much to ask of you people, will you just back the off?
Excellent work. Really excellent work. Mm-hmm. Good sharing, everybody.
And then there's this movie starring Will Smith from 2008 called Hancock. He's an addicted, rather out-of-control superhero who's forced to go to meetings. He's basically silent through all of them, but then he speaks one time, and he's cured.
Let it heal.
Come on, man, try it.
You coming here all these days? You don't have anything to share?
I'm Hancock, and I drink and stuff.
All right, thanks for sharing.
Okay.
All right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What do you think is the least helpful part of these depictions of AA?
I think showing that it's the only way to get better. Because if the program doesn't work for you, it's really not that easy to find alternative methods. Unless you really know how to work your way through the federal database of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, I mean, who's going to do that? And it makes them feel totally desperate.
Has Hollywood evolved at all in its depiction of the addict?
I would argue that it really hasn't. An addict is depicted as something that is going to end up on the street, in jail, or dead. What the federal data show us is that of the 18 million people who drink at risky levels, 10% of those are people who are really severely dependent, who shouldn't ever drink again. We use AA's yardstick of abstaining for the rest of your life, going to meetings. You know, you can't even have a bite of rum frosting at Christmas time or you're going to go on a bender. The data show us that that's just not true. The methods that have been shown to work for what's now called substance use disorder is cognitive behavioral therapy, something called motivational interviewing, which helps people resolve their ambivalence about their behavior of choice. And there are drugs that help cut cravings. And that's frankly really not that interesting to show on screen.
As you've written, something like 10% or more of the people in AA have actually been mandated to go there by a judge.
And that started with the establishment of drug courts in the early 1980s. So for the past 30 years, about 12% of AA's own membership are people who don't necessarily want to be there. There are some data that show that 12%, they fare worse than if they were just sent home.
Do you think that the judges were affected by the Hollywood portrayals of AA as a kind of cure-all?
I do. I also think it's a free program. It might help some people. And there's a huge prison overcrowding problem in our country. I spoke to several judges in my reporting who sheepishly told me, yeah, you know what? I know it really doesn't work for that many people, but we don't know what else to do with these folks.
What's it going to take for AA to no longer be the go-to first choice?
Well, this is kind of a wonky answer, but the Affordable Care Act, 62 million Americans now have coverage for alcohol use disorder who didn't have it in 2013. That's a big deal. And the more we talk about this, the more people will learn, okay, wait a minute, it may be not just me. Maybe it's not my fault that this program didn't work for me.
Your lack of moral fiber?
Your lack of moral fiber, your lack of constitutional honesty with yourself is not necessarily the problem. Maybe the program just didn't make sense for you.
Gabrielle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Gabrielle Glazer is author of Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control, and author of the upcoming article in The Atlantic, The False Gospel of Alcoholics Anonymous. We reached out to Alcoholics Anonymous for comment. It gave us a statement that said, AA has no opinion regarding scientific studies or research. As a non-professional fellowship, AA neither gathers nor distributes this information, nor do we express any opinions about it. I know what you're thinking right now. You're thinking, you know, I just don't have enough podcasts in my life. Tell me about it. Well, how about one that can accompany your TV binges? How about a podcast called On House of Cards, hosted by me? I've pulled in a pile of old White House hands, policy experts, reporters, and even the show's creator, Bo Willimon, to assess, giggle, and yes, occasionally sneer at one of our guiltiest pleasures.
We wanted to create a fictional character. I mean, clearly there are some parallels that could be drawn with Vladimir Putin, but we also...
good
disclaimer there, Bo.
Come on.
Including their initials,
Well, of course they're right. It's got to be best for the party.
Especially since he's likely to murder somebody between now and then.
I was involved in a number of summits, both as a participant and as a correspondent. And nothing was anywhere near as exciting or dramatic as this, maybe with one exception.
Mm-hmm.
That famous summit in Reykjavik, Iceland, between Reagan and Gorbachev.
I can remember being the only woman sitting at the press table and having to listen to these guys talk about, you know, I have a good joke, I can't tell it because she's here.
Right.
I mean, all the sort of stupid cliche things that you hear, they all happen.
How likely is a scenario like that?
Zero.
I was going to say minus 10, actually.
It's so stupid that it makes the way the United States conducts diplomacy look good.
It starts next week. You have to subscribe to our podcast to get it. So go to onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Meera Sharma, Kimmy Regler, Kasia Mihailovic, Andrew Chug, and Julia Hsu. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was David Grinbaum.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.